At sunset, on Thursday, the 7th of July, the squadron was, according to observation, about 40 miles from Cape Nagatsuo, or Idzu, as it is otherwise called. The heads of the ships were put offshore from midnight until 4 o'clock next morning, when the first sight of Japan was obtained from the masthead. Although the morning was fine, the atmosphere was so hazy that there was but an indistinct view of the outline of the precipitous coast. Through the mist, however, the bold promontory of Idzu could be seen rising loftily from the sea and stretching back on a crowd of mountainous elevations. The course of the squadron was now pointed directly to the entrance of the Bay of Yedo. The Commodore had determined to push his way as near as possible to Yedo, the capital, situated at the head of the bay of the same name. So he boldly steamed where steamer had never ventured before, and was soon plowing the remote waters of Japan and looking with eager interest upon the novel scene which surrounded him. As the ships closed in with the land, and as the fog occasionally lifted, a glance was here and there caught of the neighboring shores that were observed to rise in precipitous bluffs which connected landward with undulating hills. The shores of the bay, particularly on the western side, were populous with a succession of towns and villages, picturesquely grouped in groves of pines and other trees. The rising ground, which came down from the mountainous interior, abruptly terminated at the water's edge in precipitous headlands, and was crowned with white forts, more formidable in appearance than in reality. The bay was busy with trading junks, sailing up and down with their broad sails, or putting in here and there at the various ports. The fleet of Japanese boats, supposed to be government vessels, pulled out into the stream with the apparent purpose of arresting the progress of the squadron. The steamers, however, passed them contemptuously by, and as they moved along rapidly on their course, at the rate of 8 or 9 knots an hour, with all their sails furled, the Japanese were soon left behind, and in a state evidently of much amazement at the sight of the first vessels they had ever beheld, impelled by steam. As the day advanced, the sun came out, dispelling the mist which had gathered over the land, and revealing a wide prospect of the distant country. Mount Fuji was now seen rising to an immense height, with its cone-like summit covered with snow, which glistened brightly in the sun. The ships, as they approached their anchorage, continued sounding at every turn of the steamer's wheels, and they moved on slowly and cautiously until they reached a part of the bay off the city of Uraga, on the western side. The anchors were now let go, and the squadron was securely moored in Japanese waters, within a nearer distance of the capital of Yedo than any foreign vessel had ever ventured. As the ships brought to, commanding with their guns the town of Uraga and the battery upon its promontory, two guns were fired from the neighboring forts, and rockets were discharged into the air, for the purpose, probably, of signalizing the authorities at the capital. An immense fleet of government boats, each distinguished by a white flag at the stern, with a black central stripe and a tassel at the bow, came, in accordance with the usual practice in Japanese waters, hovering about the squadron. The Commodore had issued orders that no one from the shore should be allowed to board either of his vessels, except his own flagship. Some of the boats, however, attempted to get alongside the Saratoga, and the crews clung to the chains until they were repelled with considerable violence. One of the Japanese boats was allowed to come alongside the Susquehanna, and everyone on board of the steamer was struck with the resemblance of her build, as well as of the others, to that of the famous yacht America. She was trimly built, of pine wood apparently, without a touch of paint, and was propelled over the water with great swiftness by a numerous crew of boatmen, who, standing to their oars at the stern, sculled instead of rowing the boat. The men were naked, with the exception of a cloth around their loins, and were wonderfully stalwart and active fellows. Two persons, armed each with a couple of swords, a Japanese mark of official rank, stood toward the bows, and were evidently men of authority. As the boat reached the side of the steamer, one of these dignitaries held up a scroll, which turned out to be a document in the French and Dutch languages, ordering off the ships and forbidding them to anchor at their peril. No notice was taken of this very peremptory summons, and the officer on the deck of the Commodore's ship refused positively to touch the paper. This was reported to the Commodore, who kept secluded in his cabin, and he sent word that no one but a dignitary of the highest rank would be received. The Chinese interpreter attached to the squadron tried to make this understood to the Japanese, but as there seemed some difficulty, one of the two functionaries in the boat, who was the chief spokesman, cried out in very good English, "I can speak Dutch!" The Dutch interpreter was then summoned in the emergency, and a parley ensued, in the course of which it was learnt that the two officials alongside were Nagasima Zabarasuke, the vice-governor of Uraga, and Hori Tetsunosuke, an interpreter. As they insisted that they were the proper persons with whom to confer, they were admitted on board. The Japanese were now told that the Commodore bore a letter to the Emperor from the President of the United States, which he was prepared to deliver so soon as a proper person was appointed to receive it. To this they replied that Nagasaki, in the island of Kyushu, was the only place where any such communication could be received, and that the ships must proceed there immediately. This being reported to the Commodore, he sent back an answer declaring that he would not go to Nagasaki, and moreover, if the authorities did not remove their boats, which were thronging about the ships, he would disperse them by force. This last piece of intelligence produced a very prompt effect, for the vice-governor of Uraga rose hurriedly on learning it, and going to the gangway, beckoned the guard boats away. In reference to the reception of the president's letter, the Japanese dignitary said he had nothing more to say, but that another personage of higher rank would come next morning and confer with the Commodore about it. The Japanese now took their departure. The presence of the Americans in the Bay of Yeddo was evidently exciting a very lively apprehension among those on shore, for guns were frequently firing, signal rockets shooting up into the air, soldiers parading about the batteries on the various headlands, and at night bells were tolling and beacon fires were blazing and illuminating the long extent of shore. In accordance with the vice-governor's promise, his superior, the governor of Uraga, visited the Susquehanna the next day, notwithstanding the former gentleman had said at first that he himself was the proper person, and that it was against the laws of Japan for the latter to board a foreign ship. But this kind of deception is a recognized element of Japanese diplomacy, and lying is an established function of Japanese official duties, and the Commodore regulated his conduct accordingly. The governor, who sent in his name upon his gigantic red card as Kayaman Yezeman, was a more imposing personage than his vice-governor, and was robed in character with his greater pretensions. He wore the usual Japanese loose gown, something like a clerical robe, which in this case was of rich silk, embroidered with a pattern of peacock feathers. In the sash which girded his waist were thrust the two swords of dignity, and on his head was a lacquered cap, like a reversed basin, reminding one of Don Quixote's helmet of Mambrino. When he uncovered, the usual manner of dressing the hair was disclosed, in which the head is shaved from the forehead far back, Yzeyman was admitted to an interview, not, however, with the Commodore, who still preserved his dignified reserve, but with one of the captains, in the course of which he was told very much the same things that were told to his predecessor. He, finding that the Commodore was resolute in his declaration that he would not go to Nagasaki, promised to refer the subject to the Imperial government. Nagasaki, it will be recollected, is the place where the Dutch factory is established, and where the Japanese desire to confine all their relationships with foreigners, under the same degrading restrictions to those to which the Hollanders have, for the sake of a little trade, so long and so discreditably submitted. Commodore had sent out a number of boats, well-armed, to survey the bay, and as they proceeded with their work, troops of Japanese soldiers thronged the shores and the batteries, while fleets of government boats with armed men, under the command of military officers, pushed out into the stream, with the apparent purpose of intercepting the surveyors. The American lieutenant who led the survey party ordered his men to rest upon their oars a while and to adjust the caps to their pistols, that they might be prepared for what appeared to be the imminent prospect of a collision. The Japanese, however, observing the resolute attitude of the strangers, sculled their trim boats fast away, and the Americans were left undisturbed in their labors. Yzeyman, having observed the survey boats busy in the bay, expressed great anxiety and declared that it was against the Japanese laws, to which he was answered that the American laws commanded, and that the Americans were as much bound to obey the latter as his countrymen were the former. The Commodore had everything in battle array in case of a rupture. He had cleared the decks, placed his guns in position, and shot at them, and had done all that was usual before meeting an enemy. Not that the Commodore anticipated actual hostilities, but that he was resolved to be on the alert in case of an emergency. The Japanese, on their part, were no less engaged in busy preparations, furbishing up their forts and extending long stretches of black canvas to either side, with the view of giving them a more formidable aspect. Not conscious, apparently, that the telescopes from the ship's decks disclosed all their sham contrivances for effect. After the most provoking and tedious negotiation with the government of Uraga, who almost daily visited the Susquehanna and offered every obstacle in his power to the Commodore's resolute determination to be received by a proper personage to whom he might deliver the President's letter, it was, at last, reluctantly decided by the government of Japan that the Commodore's wish should be complied with.